We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, progressive talk radio from the University of Delaware.
I'm Bill Humphrey. Thanks for listening to the Arsenal for Democracy from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, brought to you by the University of Delaware and the Newark community. If you're listening live online as we record, it is May 17th, 2012. We usually live stream and record the show every Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m. Eastern at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio. We re-air Friday on 91.3 FM locally and at wvud.org on Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. The show will be available for download on iTunes and other locations after that. We will be on break for a couple weeks, so check the website to find out when we'll be back on the air. I'm coming to you live from the WVUD studios in Newark, Delaware. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Kelly. Hey, Kelly.
Hi.
And Kerry is off again this week, so filling in for her is our new favorite guest co-host, Anna, a moderator at Oh No, They Didn't Political, beaming in from the Beltway. Anna, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing quite well. Before we get started, a quick reminder that the views expressed on this program are ours alone and do not represent the views of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or anyone else. So this week I thought that instead of just going through a litany of the week's news, I thought we could focus perhaps more on discussing a few articles and stories that we've touched on previously or haven't touched on yet, but I think have a common thread here. A couple weeks ago, we had talked about, this came up kind of organically, it wasn't planned, about the issue in this country with this age gap, this, you know, generation gap that's very severe, that's turning into policy consequences that favor certain interests over others, particularly youth interests. And we talked about somebody in the chat room pointed us again to this article, which we're going to be talking about in a lot more detail tonight, this Esquire article, The War Against the Youth, from March 26th of this year by Stephen Marsh. And but the thing that particularly caught my attention this week and made me think about how that we should probably look at this in detail was a particular news item. The New York Times reported today that it's official from the Census Bureau. White births are no longer a majority in the United States. So obviously white people are still a majority. But as of this year, white births are no longer a majority of births happening in the United States. And it's obviously still the biggest plurality is white, 49.6%. This is just, you know, happened. This was actually the period was ending last July, so it's so starting in 2010 and going into 2011. That was the first year where whites were not a majority of births in the country. And of course, a lot of this is immigration, that there's non-white people who are moving to the country, and then there are a lot of offspring happening there, as people, human beings, are wont to do. And this has, of course, caused various controversies by people who don't like immigrants and people who are uncomfortable with people of a certain race. But the New York Times took this, I would say, an interesting angle, which is that it's not just an immigration debate. It's that, when, you know, what happens now with whites no longer being a majority of births in this country is, in terms of policy, is that you still have this generation that is in power, that is the much older, substantially older generation, and they are still overwhelmingly white, but more importantly, the world that they grew up in was overwhelmingly white. So, in terms of what they're used to, this is not, this is already America's starting to not look like what they remember.
They don't feel safe.
Yeah, they don't feel safe to some degree, or they're uncomfortable. And so a country that used to invest substantially more, at least for a brief period, in younger generations, now no longer doing that. And we'll get to that in more specifics with the Esquire article in a moment. But the New York Times basically making this argument that, they were saying that because the younger people now aren't as white, there's going to be more discomfort. There's long been discomfort with providing services and funding for programs for
the underprivileged,
particularly people of color, and that this is only going to get worse from here on out because the white people in the older majority are going to be uncomfortable with providing services to youth who are now increasingly less white and eventually will be majority non-white.
Can I step in? I think actually saying uncomfortable is even a really overly generous way of putting it. I think that before this ever happened, things like, as you were saying, underprivileged, for instance, education funds to help out struggling schools in inner cities or possibly in very poor rural areas, this was already something that was getting slashed more and more. And I don't think it's a matter of not being comfortable with the kids. It's a matter of not caring enough about them. And it's, I think there's a lot of just world complex. Should I explain what that is?
Yeah.
The just world complex is basically a notion that someone can have wherein they justify or explain away anything that happens to someone poorly. Any bad thing that happens to you must have been something that you deserved. So basically, anyone who is poor or anyone who is struggling greatly, anyone who has anything really wrong with their lives, there must have been something that they did to incur this. And when you see a lot of problems with education and struggling families, poverty in general, you see a lot of ideas with this notion behind it, based on this notion, creeping up. And so people often want to use this just world complex to explain away why we don't have to or why we shouldn't help people that are struggling and people that need assistance from the government, need a leg up, because they are in this hole, apparently, because of their own choices, because of their own poor decisions. And to just throw money at the problem, quote-unquote, would not help, because they are choosing to have, quote-unquote, too many children. They're choosing to disregard societal norms and not marry, whatever it happens to be. And
there's always something that they find to show,
yes,
to point to people's behavior and, quote, life choices.
Oh, yeah.
That they say is responsible.
And basically what it all comes down to is reasoning to not help, to not give up anything that you have, for instance, your tax money, to assist people that you haven't met and don't care about. And when it comes to somebody who is far away from you and living a different kind of life from you socioeconomically, and they're culturally and racially different, that just adds way too much to people that are already often clutching to what they have and not wanting to share and not wanting to hear why sharing might even be good for them.
Yeah, so to quote the specific passage that I thought was really thought-provoking in this New York Times article is, quote, "A more diverse young population forms the basis of a generational divide with the country's elderly, a group that is largely white and grew up in a world that was too. The contrast raises important policy questions. The United States has a spotty record educating minority youth. Will older Americans balk at paying to educate a younger generation that looks less like themselves? And while the increasingly diverse young population is a potential engine of growth, will it become a burden if it is not properly educated?" And then they quote Marcelo Suarez Orozco, from co-director of immigration studies at New York University. Marcelo Suarez Orozco said, "The question is, how do we reimagine the social contract when the generations don't look like one another?" So That you know, they were saying this raises important policy questions. So I thought, instead of just rehashing the news of the week, and talking about the latest pointless campaign, whatever, that we should probably try to look at some of these important policy questions. We have an hour show. Let's take the time to actually dive into some of those. Now, I think, you know, right off the bat, I'm somebody who's very pro-immigration, pro-immigration rights. I recognize that this is a country built on immigrants. It always has been, that everyone's always uncomfortable with the next wave of immigrants until they assimilate, and then they're on to the next one. Although it's, you know, it maybe gets harder if they start looking less like the traditional, in quotes, European immigrants. So I think that, you know, the immigration, that's going to be very important. A lot of other industrialized nations, European nations, Japan, et cetera, they have struggled a lot in recent years with continued funding sources and solvency for their entitlements programs and such, with their, you know, aging, graying populations that are unsupported by a shrinking population base among younger people. We are the only industrialized nation that has staved that off, and that has been clearly not because of white people, as this new change shows, that the high birth rate among non-white populations, and particularly immigrant influxes, has been responsible for propping up the continuation of the system. Might not work out indefinitely, but it's going to keep us going for a lot longer. And, you know, at best, this resentment toward immigrants needs to stop, because they're the only people that are actually keeping the whole system from falling apart. But, you know, the other thing is just that this generational divide is something we've talked about previously a little bit on this show, but not in huge detail. I feel very, very strongly about this, as people who follow me know. And we're going to be talking about that from a lot of different angles tonight. But I feel very keenly that there is a lot of good ideas, potential from the millennial generation that we are all a part of, that on this show, the three of us, I mean, that is being lost. And this is. You know, could turn into sort of a lost generation, and that's deeply, deeply troubling. And I feel a lot of resentment toward this. You know, the claims that are thrown at millennials, saying that, you know, they're so entitled and they're so whatever, and just it's constant criticism, refusing to acknowledge that we might have any good ideas, and yet
it's often so self-contradictory as well.
Yeah, and yet not actually doing. That was what we talked about two episodes ago when we brought up that Esquire article in the first place. Was this idea of not caring about any long-term problems that are actually going to affect. Like, it's like, if you're not going to let us get into government and try to make change, if you're going to criticize us and tell us that we're, you know, not wise enough, whatever, then you better be acting on our behalf as trustees to make decisions that are actually going to benefit us, not just yourselves. You can't make short-term budgetary decisions that are going to screw us over in the long run. You can't ignore global warming. You can't just only focus on things that have to do with the older populations just because they vote more. It's so offensive, and it's such bad policy, Kelly.
Yeah, and America has a lot of cyclical problems, and the place to break the cycle is with youth. And so if there's any place that we need to be dumping resources and thinking long-term is the youth. You know, you talk about in the state of Delaware, it costs $32,000 a year to house a prisoner. But people who are raised by people who have been to jail are more likely to go to jail. And we talk about health care and the drain of Medicaid and Medicare on society. People who are raised by unhealthy people are more likely to be unhealthy. So if you want to sort of, people who are raised on welfare are more likely to live on welfare as adults. And if you want to stop these sort of things, the youth is the place where you have to jump in. So I think that it is difficult as a politician to say, you know, we should spend X amount of dollars here and we're going to see great returns in 20 years. That's not a popular platform to stand on, but it seems like the only logical, practical way to move forward with many of the problems that we're facing right now.
Right. And that's what Kelly and I were talking about before the show, is this notion that, you know, if you're gonna have to make an investment for 18 to 22 years, probably in most cases. And that is a long time to make an investment. But that's the government's job. That's why we have a government. I'm sorry, corporations, fine. I get that you're going quarter to quarter each year and you have a very short-term scope. You have to turn a profit every 4 years.
And you're looking out.
Four times a year. But the government is supposed to be thinking long-term and isn't trying to make a profit. The government's trying to... And you know, as we'll get to, I think, in a bit, it's not even like it's dumping, like, money into a bottomless pit if you invest in the youth. It's like... The assumption is that you're going to make a good investment, and then you're going to get the money back many times over later when they are actually able to do jobs and have jobs that make money instead of just struggling to find work. I mean, I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago on the show. The new statistic, people who graduated in the last, like, 2 years, I think that more than half of them have been unable to find work. I mean, that's ridiculous.
That's so many problems wrapped in one, I feel.
Right. Well,
the devaluing of the like new employee, of the starter employee, combined with the devaluing of the bachelor's degree in America, there's so much going on, and so much of it is not acknowledged. You were talking earlier about just the judgments that are put on us, and something was reminding me of an article that I read about how basically everything that's wrong with our generation, as far as people that are new to the job market, fresh out of secondary education, everything like that, is really our fault because we're not stimulating the economy as we should, as if we're suddenly just like our fraction of the American economy is responsible for that everything that's wrong because we're not spending enough of our money.
Yeah, and then ironically...
And so to contradict every other complaint about us, we're taking out loans, we're not taking out enough loans.
Yeah, well...
We're spending all our money so we don't invest, we're investing so much so we're not buying things. And so it was basically blaming us for doing things like continuing to live with our parents after graduation to save money, spending less money on things like cars and apartments.
Right. Well, the Esquire thing said if you look 1984, people who were over 65, the average net worth was $120,457. People who are 35 and younger, their net worth was $11,521. You go up to 2009, people who are 65 and over, now the average net worth is $170,494. And, you know, that's probably relatively reasonable change due to inflation or whatever. But then 35 and younger, the average net worth is $3,662, and yet we're being blamed for not spending more, not stimulating the economy, and then we're also simultaneously being blamed for having high credit card debts and things like that, and then we're not allowed to go bankrupt on student loans. It's the only debt that you can't go bankrupt on. You constantly have to be paying off the student loans. But, you know, oh, well, you shouldn't have gotten those student loans or whatever. Oh, well, that ignores the fact that the overall cost of college has jumped like something, what, fourfold at least in just the past like 10 years.
You don't go to college, you failed yourself.
Exactly.
It's the self-fulfilling prophecy thing again. I think I really believe in the just world complex messing up a lot of things because there is no winning scenario. And there's that epic quote from Mitt Romney of if you want to go to college, just borrow money from your parents. And just this, like, mindless, no idea, you know, there's problems with not going to college, choosing not to go to college at all. There's problems with trying to get a trade skill and kind of meeting it halfway. There's problems with going to college and the loans that you might need to take. There's problems with getting a scholarship that might get pulled from you. I think when you said, how much was it again? It was like $3,000-something?
Yeah, $3,000.
$3,002.
It was $3,662.
I strongly believe that a huge component of that is because we are becoming such a generation of people living with debt. And we might have a decent amount of money in our account, for instance, or we might have a decent job, which is paying a reasonable amount of money for how long we've been in the job market and, you know, what degrees we have on the wall. But we have behind that so much getting pulled from us every month for the debt that it took to get there, because we started with nothing, or because what little we tried to get, for instance, say, a community college degree, costs so much more than it did one generation ago.
Yeah, and it's so frustrating to hear. That's the issue. You know, normally it wouldn't be, you know, it sounds on its face problematic if I start saying, like, you know, that we know better and that the old people are out of touch, whatever, and that
some
they shouldn't be making decisions.
And some of them are showing they're behind.
But Right. But the thing is, then I hear people talking about, well, you know, in the 1970s or in the 1980s, I went to a state school and I paid, you know, several thousand dollars a semester, whatever. I'm sorry. It can now cost like $60,000 to go to a state school for a year.
Yeah.
People and the people, they don't know that. It's like, why are you talking about this issue and making any proclamations one way or the other if you don't even know, because you haven't actually paid attention? Is it like it's so mind-boggling that you can't possibly conceive that it had actually gone up that much, so your brain just shuts down and you refuse to accept new information from the past 10 years?
They have their experience and they do not want to accept that the experience of people that are younger than them might be different. I think there is, you know, the common trope of the complaining younger person of everything is so hard, I don't want to do it. And when that combines with things actually legitimately being harder, there's a resistance to listening to the different experience and how things might have actually become more tough since you were a kid. And you just, there are so many, I have been reading so many articles of either candidates like Mitt Romney or the female congresswoman whose name escapes me, who explain how it was fine
Virginia for
them. Fox. So the idea that it's becoming a problem for other people to get through college without a staggering amount of debt is boggling to them and must mean that they were making some sort of horrible decision in their debts or how much they were, you know, asking for something. They must have done something wrong.
Exactly. Kelly, your thoughts.
This is a generation that has left us with trillions and trillions of dollars of national debt. So to... So for them to put that debt on us, and quite frankly, probably on our children too, it's going to be around for a while, and then put in place so many obstacles to success, is just a total recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it's like they didn't pay for the Iraq War, and then they're like, why did you take out debt to pay for college that you need to have now, because not having a bachelor's degree is death in this economy? Like it's and then saying, oh, and then to top it off saying, oh, so guys, you're actually finishing school at the height of the deepest recession in, you know, post Great Depression history. You're finishing school, you have mountains of debt, you can't go bankrupt on it, you have to start paying it immediately. There's not much of a grace period there. I think it's like 6 months. And then you're saying, now we need to pay for the Iraq War. Not later, because we can't put the debt on our grandchildren. No, you have to pay it now. It's like, so it's just like, you know, and then I think we'll get to this in just a moment, but this, you know, this resistance to raising taxes on the people who can actually afford it. Oh, we all got to sacrifice and pay our fair share. No. I'm not sure that we do, because if you're
really
not paying,
the spin that's been created for, and this is going to tie in later to the TED talk that you want to discuss. I think there's been an amazing, amazing amount of spin. I mean, just looking back on it and having seen it sort of with 2020 hindsight and seeing how it's turned the discussion since it began. I don't remember when someone somewhere started the trope of the very, very rich being job creators and using those interchangeably or using one for the other. And that started, I think, on conservative networks and just spread.
Yeah.
And it's become second nature to people that are talking heads. And things like that, little tricks like that, have become incredibly powerful in manipulating the way that we discuss the problems that we have with the economy and with job growth.
Right. And you know, I don't want to make it sound like that I'm saying we shouldn't be providing these benefits and services for the older people. You know, yeah, they earned it with Social Security and stuff like that. I think we should protect those benefits, but those benefits aren't in danger. You hear those statistics tossed around by Republicans being like, you know, such and such huge percentage of young people don't believe that Social Security will be around for them when they're older. Yeah, you know what? I have my doubts about it being around too. Not because it's not a program we could rescue, not because it's not a good program, but because you're clearly not going to take the action necessary to sustain it, because you don't want to do minor things like raise the payroll tax cap on people who are making a huge amount of money and aren't ever going to actually need the Social Security benefits, because you won't tax them to help pay into the system, and then you refuse to make fixes like that, and then you clearly show that you're willing to carve out those benefits down the road, if not right now, because you can't alienate the voters who are over 65 who are going to vote in Florida and places like that. It's like, no, we're going to hollow those benefits out later so that young people don't get them later. Yeah, I have my doubts about Social Security being around. And I'm saying we should be paying for these programs for the older people, but it needs to be balanced. I mean, you know, look at the stat in that Esquire article. For every dollar that we spend on a child, the U.S. government spends $2.4 on the elderly. And there was this great quote in this article about that we're not investing in our children growing up well and well educated. We're investing in the ability of older people to die comfortably. It's like you know, there should be minimum standards and protections for people who are aging. That's why we established Social Security in the first place. That's why we expanded it to include Medicare, so people aren't dying in poverty and sick when they're older just because they're not working anymore. You know, I don't want to change that. I'm just saying that that is also money that's going into not a lost cause, but that's a terminal cause that you're putting it into, as opposed to investing into the people who are actually going to be here to face all of these massive global problems later.
Right. Kelly. There's another great statistic in the Esquire article. A couple with average to high wages will pay $899,000 $899,000 in taxes. But they will receive about $1,016,000 of entitlement benefits over their lives. So this is highly unsustainable, obviously. And it's interesting to see that we are sort of spending money on people after their, you know, after their peak productivity, instead of investing money so that their productivity can be greater.
And they should be able to withdraw the, you know, something like the amount that they put in, because Lord knows there are people that have been dutifully paying their taxes and haven't been the ones that are screwing us over. At the same time, there's such a disproportionate pull on funds right now that I really wonder how much of this has to do with the way there's a theme of panic in the 24-hour news cycle that is so strongly affects the elderly more than people like us. We have, in a way that we're so desensitized to it in some ways, and
right.
Someone was saying that it used to be that if a newscaster told you something, it was true.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like two generations ago, if someone on the news looked you in the eye and told you a fact, it was an actual fact. And the huge disparity between the news then and the news now, and the generation of people that are, let's say, after the age of 60, who are nervous anyway because there are legitimate problems with the economy, legitimate problems and changes in the country, are being fed information by a source that used to be much more trustworthy. And it's now not only not as trustworthy, but bent on the angle of keeping you scared so you continue to watch. And how much of that affects how strongly and irrationally they cling to their own benefits while just acting as if the rest of it is not going to matter because the world is going to burn within 20 years.
Right. And yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of changes that young people have grown up with and seem to be coping with much better. You know, that's a good example. Another example I've read about recently is that the people who are super, super stressed out with having to be kind of constantly on call when they're not, you know, doctors or whatever, people having to take their work home all the time, that sort of thing, this sort of, you know, I'm always at work type of mentality, that is really stressing out the people who used to just sit in their cubicle, do their 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then be done with it and not have to work anymore at the end of the day. The people who are coping with it best, ironically, are the ones under the most pressure, but it's that they grew up with that assumption that that was how it was going to be. They've never known any other way. They're just used to it, that their free time is being cut into, et cetera. Some other statistics from that Esquire article that I wanted to read, just to prove that we're not having this irrational, whiny little kid freak out here, you know, arbitrarily resenting the people. Well, Anna is, but the federal government spends $480 billion on Medicare, $68 billion on education, $62 billion on prescription drugs, $8 billion on Head Start. So, again, $480 billion for Medicare compared to just $68 for education. Like again, I understand the value of putting the money into Medicare, but I'm saying, you know what's more important than that, that we should also be funding? The people who are going to continue to be paying into this system and are going to be around a lot longer. I mean, you know, I hate to say this, but no offense, some of you are not going to be here. We are. We have to actually be prepared to deal with these problems, deal with a new economy, deal with a globalized economy, deal with the fact that certain jobs aren't coming back, deal with the fact that we're moving into a service economy, etc.
And hopefully be able to construct a kind of economic system where this isn't going to happen again.
And where there's...
This is another issue of intersectionality where there are so many issues going on, and a big one is that the reason that this generation is so expensive is because we've gotten to the point where science and nutrition allows people to live longer, but not necessarily live better. And there's a lot of people that are reaching incredibly long ages considering what our standards used to be for long life, but they aren't well. So you can live, you know, into your 70s, where previously you might live into your late 50s. You can live, you know, to your 90s, but good God, you need so many, you know, pain medications, so many surgeries for all the falls you're going to take, so many different things, especially for memory issues, which is just a whole, you know, conversation in itself.
Now,
it's just that it's expensive to live that long.
Now, transitioning slightly, we've been kind of hinting that we're getting into this the whole time here, but, you know, I was just talking about that issue of the new economy and being able to cope with that new economy. There are a lot of people right now, and this is true around the world in other industrialized nations, who are kind of just barely getting by. And there's always going to be some people who are just barely getting by. But there's just huge segments now of the population who used to have those stable jobs, often blue-collar jobs. Those jobs are gone. They are not coming back. And people are chronically underemployed or just, you know, constantly doing odd jobs, just trying to find a bit of work here and there, maybe 6 months at best, etc. That in the long run is I would say unsustainable from building a strong economy and having a solid tax base, but it's also I mean, it's not healthy for those workers either to be under that kind of chronic stress like that. But the other thing is just that you know instead of building a small business or something like that, you don't have time to be creative. You don't have time to think. You're just like, I need to just get that next amount of money that's going to get me to the next, you know, to point B. I don't have time to take risks and try for something longer. So let's move to that thing. Nick Hanauer was a venture capitalist from Seattle, and this was reported by the National Journal and some other places. This was on their Restoration Roundtable blog, which has the interesting subtitle of America's Crumbling Foundation and the People Who Might Fix It. And Hanauer was a guy who was one of the earliest investors in Amazon outside of the founder's family, Amazon.com. And so he made a lot of money. And he gave this TED Talk explaining this, making the counter argument against this point that Anna brought up just a few minutes ago, this meme that rich people are job creators. Now, I happen to think on its face that's kind of a stupid and ridiculous argument, because that's basically saying, okay, here is your set of people right now who have money. These people are job creators because they have money. There will never be any other job creators because those people don't have money yet. That, like, clearly that should be like a there's a rational hole there that should be clicking with people, but it's clearly not. So he gave this speech, which I think is really important. So he said, "It is astounding how significantly one idea can shape a society and its policies. Consider this one. If taxes on the rich go up, job creation will go down. This idea is an article of faith for Republicans and seldom challenged by Democrats, and has shaped much of today's economic landscape. But sometimes the ideas that we know to be true are dead wrong." And then he gives some examples of past wrong ideas. He said, "I have started or helped start dozens of businesses and initially hired lots of people. But if no one could have afforded to buy what we had to sell, my businesses would have all failed and all those jobs would have evaporated. That's why I can say with confidence that rich people don't create jobs, nor do businesses large or small. What does lead to more employment is a circle of life-like feedback loop between customers and businesses. Only consumers can set in motion this virtuous cycle of increasing demand and hiring. In this sense, an ordinary middle-class consumer is far more of a job creator than a capitalist like me. So when business people take credit for creating jobs, it's a little like squirrels taking credit for creating evolution. In fact, it's the other way around. Anyone who's ever run a business knows that hiring more people is a capitalist course of last resort, something we do only when increasing customer demand requires it. In this sense, calling ourselves job creators isn't just inaccurate, it's disingenuous." And then he basically goes on to criticize the tax system that favors the rich in the name of job creation. Now, see, that's the thing. If you just look at it from a basic economic standpoint, there aren't that many people who are going to challenge the notion that the United States has a consumer-driven economy. I mean, the economy, the biggest driver of economic growth is consumers buying things in the United States. Other economies have less reliance on that than we do, but that's been for decades now our big thing. So I don't understand this notion that you know, we need to give more money to the rich because they're going to drive economic growth. That's, of course, the trickle-down economic theories of Reaganomics. That idea is so stupid.
I absolutely understand not why it makes sense, but why this ploy worked. Because when you think of the people that are mostly the 90% of people that are listening to the news and getting fed this don't have the level of education that we might be privileged enough to have. And, you know, when you feed them something like, think about it. Who's your boss's boss? The one that makes all the hiring decisions, the one that really keeps, you know, your business running. He's very rich. He's the job creator because he's in charge of your boss's job and everybody's job underneath him. And that sort of top-down mentality without thinking about the deeper implications of what's keeping that business going could make a lot of sense to a lot of people that don't simply know better.
Right.
Or haven't thought it through.
And I think that, you know, people don't know necessarily that it is a consumer-driven economy. And that's been one of the biggest things for the past 20, 30 years that's been such a problem is that we've been sending all these jobs overseas. And the argument is, okay, well, now we can get consumer goods cheaper. And that's good because, you know, then you have to spend less of your hard-earned money on whatever. But the cycle sort of breaks down when you realize that you used to have the money to buy things because you were employed here. You are
and
no longer employed here.
Job,
the job is now overseas. You are now no longer making money. Or if you are still making money, other people in your town are no longer making money. I mean, they, you know, a couple years ago, they closed the Chrysler plant in Newark, Delaware. That was a lot of people who had a job making something here in the United States. That was a solid working class job that they could count on until it finally did go away. And all of those people now had to find something else to do. The question is, of course, then, do they have the skills and the resources that they can then go find something else to do? Not everyone does.
What's really sad about situations like that is you're competing against every single person that used to be your coworker.
Right.
So you're setting out your set of skills and your resume, and it's almost identical to what maybe 30, 40, 50, maybe 500 people who had your exact same kind of job who were fired at the same time as you. And they're probably looking for the same kind of work in the same kind of area.
And it's Delaware. I mean, it's even smaller here. So
yeah.
you're literally just and so a lot of people, they're just not going to be able to find jobs. They're going to have to, you know, like I said, be scrambling for those odd jobs, just trying to make ends meet, doing a little here, a little there. They're not going to be able to find that permanent job, whatever. That option is no longer available. That means that all of those people who previously had the luxury to not even buy, you know, fancy things, but maybe, you know, to buy a car, now they're going to have to wait twice as long to get a car, something like that.
Yes, similarly. I think this is especially relevant when we're talking about taxes, who has to pay more taxes, who gets to pay less taxes. And Hanauer said, the annual earnings of people like me are hundreds, if not thousands of times greater than those of the median American, but we don't buy hundreds or thousands of times more stuff. So when we talk about if Mitt Romney is going to keep a little extra money in his pocket, he's not going to spend it. It's going to sit in a savings account, or a middle class American who might get to go out to eat once in a while, or, you know, buy new clothes or something. And that's really what's driving the economy.
And there are actual economic, microeconomic theories that explain that principle, which is like, if you have a car that is a used car that's all beat up, if you get another ding in your car, you're not going to go spend money to fix that ding. If you have one that's not, you know, that's brand new and shiny, and then you get something, then you are going to spend, like, the people are going to spend on, you know, some people are going to be able to, like, and the reason, of course, is that if you have the new car, then you also presumably have the disposable income, and you can make a decision whether or not you're going to go get that fixed. But if you're poor, if you're really low income, then you've got a whole bunch of other things. You've already spent your whole paycheck. You don't have that luxury of doing that. You've already spent your whole paycheck on actual important things like food and clothes.
Yeah, there is an expectation that people are supposed to be stimulating the economy who literally cannot afford to be spending that money right now.
And the thing is, if you give a tax break and, you know, give a new, you know, give a handout, as they like to call it, the critics, give a handout to those poor people, boom, that goes right back into the economy.
Right.
Because they're going to go buy a new refrigerator that they've been needing for the last year and a half.
Yeah, they you know, they really need, like, it's like, you know, they're gonna use it on something that they really need. Whereas if you give it to the rich, like, what is the point? Mitt Romney has $250 million lying around, apparently, in the Cayman Islands or wherever. He clearly, if you give him a rebate for $5,000 more, I mean, you know, to quote Jay-Z, what's 50 grand to a, you know what, like me? Will you please remind me? Okay, there's a reason.
I can remind you, and that amount is nothing. It's worth almost nothing.
There's a reason that Jay-Z says that in the song, which I can't say the title of because I'm white, but you know which song I'm talking about if you're familiar with the song. He got a $50,000 fine. That dude has $500 million. His wife has $500 million. Between them, they are a billionaire family, between the two of them. And he got a $50,000 fine. And that's the point of the line in that song, is like, to him, a $50,000 fine, whoop-de-doo, it doesn't mean anything. However, if you gave $50,000 to someone who was, you know, lower middle class or something like that.
Or a young person,
boom. Like, we could, you know, I know so many people who could go and pay off their student, you know, loan debt, like a large chunk of their student loan debt if they had $50,000 like that. Okay, so, you know, That's the point, is that there's the whole distribution is set up wrong. Anyway, we have to take a quick break, and then we'll get back to talking more about why the distribution is wrong on a lot of these things, why the policies are geared so incorrectly beyond just the fact that old people vote and young people allegedly don't, so that's why they're going to cater to the old people, which I think, you know, that's an oversimplification of what's happening. So we'll get back to that in just a moment here after this break.
Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy, arming progressives with the phrases and facts to fight back.
Hey, I'm Bill Humphrey here with Arsenal for Democracy with Kelly in studio, and joining me from the Beltway via Skype, Anna. And we've been talking about this generational divide, how it's getting worse, why it exists, why it is causing serious problems in policymaking. So I wanted to talk about the institutional obstacle here. We know that Congress is getting older. That's something that anybody can look up pretty easily. The actual members of Congress are getting older than they used to be, especially in the Senate. I mean, we had a guy who was just defeated in Indiana, Dick Lugar, in a primary. He was running for his bazillionth term as like an 80-year-old or something. He lost his primary, but not because of his age. It was because he doesn't live in the state of Indiana anymore.
Technicality.
And the, you know, that was really hammered in on by his Tea Party opponent, the state treasurer. But that, you know, on average, there's just a lot of much older people, in the Congress, and they're going to represent those interests a lot more than they're going to represent the youth interests. And the argument has always been, the older people, they have more experiences, they're wiser. They may have more experiences, but they're not necessarily in tune with the experiences of a completely different generation in a rapidly changing world. If you weren't, If you barely know what the internet is, I feel like you shouldn't be in Congress. This has been a theme chronically on this show, that like when we talked about SOPA and PIPA, that if you're going to be regulating the internet, you better know what the internet is. That seems like a baseline we should probably have established at some point. Clearly we didn't do that. And so they're still saying, you know, that they're more qualified to make these decisions, et cetera, and saying, oh, you know, like, I think that we would be a lot better off if we put a bunch of 20-somethings, maybe under 35s, in government, capped it off in Congress at 35. We could really get some things done, because we're not going to just screw over the old people. That's not going to happen.
We have grandparents.
We have grandparents, too. We have reasons to make sure that they get what they deserve. The thing is that we also are going to be around for a lot longer and have an actual interest in solving problems that may be coming down the road in a lot longer than a two-year election cycle outlook that they're so obsessed with. But institutionally, there's been a lot of obstacles. One of the things that I was really passionate about after the 2010 election and until the beginning of February 2011 was this idea that we needed to change the rules in the Senate. Everyone knows that the Senate is basically broken, I think, at this point. We can probably all acknowledge that. The fact that you had a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate with a 59-vote majority for most of the time, up to that 60-vote threshold filibuster, and a Democratic White House, and the Senate wasn't able to accomplish anything unless they could actually get one Republican to go to their side, and then typically that meant watering down the legislation a lot until somebody finally cracked on the Republican side because they had good party discipline. Clearly that system wasn't working. So it wasn't even like, let's abolish the filibuster. It was, let's reform it. Let's get rid of secret holds. Let's get rid of public holds. Because it's, I mean, seriously, we have a Democratic institution where somebody can go and say, I'm going to hold up every single piece of legislation and every judge that's been nominated, every executive cabinet position that's been nominated. I'm going to hold up every single appointment because I am mad about something. We literally had guys doing that, Jeff Sessions from Alabama, holding up the entire Senate business and like 87 judicial nominees because he wanted to get a defense contract for a company that had donated money to his campaign that was based in Alabama. You know, that one person could do that, that wasn't even a secret hold. And so a couple of these senators, the younger ones, and by younger, I mean they're in their 40s, Jeff Merkley from Oregon and Tom Udall from New Mexico, they came up with this proposal. It was a very moderate reform, and they said, look, we have the constitutional option that the Senate gets to change its rules at the beginning of each Congress. That means you have one chance in January every 2 years to change the rules, and it can be done by a simple majority. If you don't change it in that period, you can change the rules at any other time, assuming you get 67 votes. Obviously, you're not going to get 67 votes in a hyper-polarized atmosphere like this for a rules change, especially if it's going to hurt one party. And they were saying, you know, we're not trying to eliminate the filibuster completely. We're just saying, you know, some reasonable things. Get rid of the holds so that you can't just hold up things. One of the really simple things, you'd be surprised how simple this was saying you shouldn't be able to filibuster on a motion to proceed. So, you know, a motion to open the debate, a motion to end the debate. You shouldn't be able to block that just because you're mad at something. You say, you know, we're still keeping it in place for you know, that you can you still have one chance to filibuster something if you're really, really strong about it. This is something that the filibuster was used in a very limited fashion, only, you know, a few dozen times for most of the last half of the 19th century and a significant chunk of the early 20th century. And then it increased during the civil rights movement because a lot of the old segregationists were voting against things. And so then they lowered the filibuster threshold from 67 votes to 60. This is not anywhere in the Constitution. This is entirely a Senate rules thing that they could change if they wanted to. But they did not change this. There were some proposals like we should maybe make it that you can initially the filibuster is this amount of time, and then if it continues to, you know, then you knock it down from 59 to 58 votes or something like that. There were some proposals to make it a 55 vote threshold, which still would have been problematic for the Democrats. You know, it's not like it was a giveaway to the Democrats because they don't have 55 votes this year. So they had one chance in January to make this change by a simple majority. And people like Harry Reid and a lot of these older senators said, no, that's not the way we do things in the Senate, and we wouldn't want the other party to do it to us if we were in the minority. Well, guess what? The other party's going to do it as soon as they get into the majority, and I don't care which party's it. The point is that if you look at all the problems, we have healthcare, the economy, global warming, all these other things, and Harry Reid kept on saying for 2 years, no, we're not even going to bring this up to a vote because we don't have the 59 or we don't have the 60 votes in place for it. That's absurd. That is absurd. We have major, major problems, And then we're saying, no, we can't handle it because we don't have this arbitrarily high threshold. How are you going to get a massive wave election with a giant majority in the House, a huge majority in the Senate that hasn't been seen in decades, and a Democratic White House, and then we're not going to do anything on global warming at all? When there were people who, they got a House version passed, there were people working on it in the Senate for years, but we, because we don't have an arbitrary 60 votes, we're not going to get anything done. And so they, so Harry Reid basically saying, no, we're not going to make any of these changes. We don't need to do that. We're going to make a gentleman's agreement with the Republicans. They're going to make fewer secret, you know, not seek, we're going to get away with secret holds. We're done with that. They're going to make fewer holds. They're going to voluntarily, yeah, really, the Republicans are going to voluntarily do something for you? That's a really nice sentiment. I wonder where you were for the past 2 to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years where that didn't happen and the Republicans repeatedly rammed through things when they were in the majority. They used reconciliation to pass tax cuts. Budget reconciliation is only supposed to be used if you're going to be reducing the deficit. You want to tell me how lowering taxes on the rich is going to reduce the structural deficit over the long term? I have no idea. They fired the parliamentarian to get that one through. The Republicans do whatever they want to do to get it through. Why are the Democrats going to play nice with them just because that's how it used to be done? You realize people in the Senate don't actually talk to each other anymore, especially people from the other party. That's an extreme rarity. They used to be all chummy and they could go over and eat with each other and meet each other's families. They don't do that anymore. And the problem is, you can be sad that that's not the way it's done anymore, but that's not the way it's done anymore. And at a certain point, you have to acknowledge that that's not the way it's done anymore and make a change. But they said, no, we're not going to make a change. And then we almost defaulted on the U.S. federal debt in 2011 like 2 times. The government almost shut down like 4 times. And then, I wonder if we might have a problem. Oh, so Harry Reid finally shows up and says this past week, if there were ever a time when Tom Udall and Jeff Merkley were prophetic, it's tonight. These two young, fine senators said it was time to change the rules of the Senate, and we didn't. And they were right. The rest of us were wrong. Or most of us, anyway. What a shame. Mr. President, I am finished here, but I just want to say again, for those who are listening here and watching, Senator Udall and Senator Merkley want to do something to change the rules regarding filibuster. If there were anything that ever needed changing in this body, it's the filibuster rule, because it's been abused, abused, and abused. Wow! Congratulations, Harry! Harry Reid, welcome to the party. What were you doing for the entire time you were Senate Majority Leader after the 2006 election? Did you fail to notice the hundreds of filibusters compared to the dozen for 50 years that happened? You just now noticed that we can't get anything done? And what was it that finally caught your attention? Something called the Export-Import Bank Reauthorization or something like that didn't, like, pass. And that, I guess the House had already passed, and he was mad that he couldn't get the Republicans to sign on in the Senate version. I mean, hello, it's not like global warming and having a climate solution caught your attention. You were just like, no, I can't do it, it's too hard. And then he was just like, no, we're not going to change the rules. It made me so angry when that happened last January, the notion that we weren't going to change the rules when clearly the system was fundamentally broken. And the thing is, yes, if the Republicans get a majority and they eliminate this filibuster or severely reduce its ability, yes, a lot of really bad stuff is going to get through. But you know what's probably better than not letting all the bad stuff? How about, I want to actually get something done, basically. There are all these issues, and we're not getting any solutions. And the thing is, the American people love when something actually gets done. They love when people take action. They reward that. We could have done that. We missed the opportunity. So the Republicans are now going to probably reform this rule if they recapture the Senate. And even if they do, yes, it's unfortunate. They'll pass some really bad legislation for 2 years. But then the American people will clearly see which party passed the bad legislation and decide whether or not they want to reelect them. And the Democrats also have a better opportunity without a filibuster in place to try to, instead of like not being able to do anything in the minority, they might actually be able to get some people from the other party to come over on a few counter proposals so they could actually show, even if they don't get passed, show we're Democrats, we have a different plan, this is terrible legislation that's being passed, but we have a plan. If you elect us next time, this is what we're going to put through. We have the support for this. We just need a few more votes. Not, we need 60 votes, which is the single biggest cop-out that any Senate Majority Leader has probably ever done in the history of ever. And this is why we're unable to solve issues like global warming, solve the default situation, actually raise taxes on the wealthy when we need to do that, extend the Bush tax cuts for the middle class, but let it roll, let it get repealed for the rich, etc., let it expire. These sorts of things, I mean, it's just ridiculous, the incredible threshold that we now have to reach on every single policy, things that used to be so mundane, filled with such bipartisan support. You can cry as much as you want that there's not bipartisanship in the Senate anymore, but those days are over. Once those days are over, you have to acknowledge that the situation has changed, and you have to acknowledge that if you're the world's biggest economy, one of the biggest military powers on the face of the earth, and that you are a huge polluter, that you are responsible for a lot of things that happen, positive and negative, around the world in 2012, you better be able to actually make forward decisions so that there's some positive momentum in some direction on any of these issues. Even if it's not what you like, then you just vote new people in the next time instead of trying to get some ridiculous threshold of people, because that's so arbitrary and stupid. The idea, you know, this is presumably a democratic system. You expect that you vote in a majority, even if it's only 52, 51 senators, that they should be able to pass an agenda if they want to, instead of having to get some arbitrary supermajority that nobody ever conceived of, that only came into existence as a permanent thing in the last 2 to 4 years.
Do you need a minute?
No, because we're basically out of time, but closing thoughts, Anna, in the remaining 30 seconds, and then we'll get some from Kelly.
Word. That's all.
Yeah, the underlying theme is definitely a failure to be able to see in the future. They're talking about the obstacles that youth face, education, the filibuster. So we need some politicians that are willing to look beyond their next election.
Indeed. Well, that concludes today's show. Thanks for listening to the Arsenal for Democracy on May 17th, 2012. The FM broadcast of this episode airs Friday, May 18th at 2 p.m. Eastern from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark. Tonight's episode will be available for download from iTunes and other locations after the FM broadcast. We are on hiatus for a couple weeks, so please check back on billhumphreyresearch.com/radio to find out when the next episode will be recorded. My in-studio co-host tonight has been Kelly, filling in for Carrie via Skype from Northern Virginia, Anna, moderator from ONTD Political. From the WVUD studios in Newark, Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approved this message. Good night.